Hello and welcome to episode 37 of the Rugby Chat podcast. Bit of housekeeping before we get started today. First thing is first, Patreons. Thank you very much, Patreons, for supporting me. Guys, if you want to jump on the Patreon, it starts at £2 a month. There is a 7-day free trial as well, so you can come and see what it's all about. But there's exclusive content. You get access to the vlogs early. You get to know who the podcast guests are early. If the podcasts are pre-recorded, you get early access to them as well. There's some merch on the way. There's all sorts of cool stuff happening over on Patreon, not to mention a Discord and some other bits and bobs. I also just want to give a quick shout out to my friend Dan, who has been an absolute diamond recently, helping me move all sorts of enclosures around and being an extra set of hands whilst I've been doing all these enclosure upgrades, which I've been doing. All the changes have been vlogged as well. So if you need another reason to go and join the Patreon, there is another reason. Let's see who is in the comments, if anybody, quickly, and then we will crack on with today's guest. So, what we got? Fiona says she is watching the rugby, but she'll catch up later. So, thank you very much, Fiona. If you're listening back, I appreciate you. And we also got Dan in the chat as well. So, hey, Dan, how's it going? Thank you guys for coming along. So, today's guest has actually been on the podcast twice before, but never a like traditional episode. So you might have seen him on the Big Fat Rugby Chat Quiz of the Year, or you might have seen him on the 12 Pods of Christmas. But today, all the way from the United States, please welcome Chris from Copperhead Reptilia. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad, mate. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. And we have got a normal episode today. I'm not going to make you sing or answer any questions that are not related to our conversation.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. Lovely to have you. So we'll get straight into it, really. I like to start each episode with a section that I like to call Get to Know. It's 10 this or that questions. They get to know the person behind the social media account a little bit better. So if you're happy, we'll get started.
Sounds good.
Fantastic. So, cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Good. snakes or lizards?
Snakes.
Frogs or salamanders?
Salamanders.
Centipedes or millipedes?
Millipedes.
Spiders or scorpions?
Spiders.
Birds or butterflies?
Birds.
Grasslands or woodlands?
Woodlands.
Beach or mountains?
Mountain.
Hot climate or cold climate?
Hot, for sure.
Nice. And finally, the most important question of the entire podcast, what is your favorite biscuit?
I'm always a sucker for a good shortbread.
Oh, I like a shortbread. That's a good shout. That's a rogue one as well. It doesn't come up very often, but yeah, I like a shortbread.
Yeah.
Very good. So that's the most important part of the entire podcast out of the way, and people can argue in the comments about biscuits if they want to. So let's get into the nitty-gritty, I suppose, Chris. So could you give the listeners and myself a sort of history lesson into you and your reptile keeping career, for want of a better phrase?
Yeah. So, I grew up in I'm from around the Detroit area. So not really a ton of reptile stuff around here. I know a lot of people have that whole, you know, I grew up in the, you know, going to the forest or hiking, all that. I didn't really have that. You know, the most we had were, garter snakes every so often, or like toads. So when I was, I want to say 10, because I'd had the whole, like, you know, caught a garter snake in the yard, kept it for a year or two, you know, hermit crabs, the normal things that kids have. And my dad came home from work one day and his coworker had offered him a python, you know, a ball python, a normal one. And so I got him when I was 10 because they knew I really liked reptiles. So my parents let me get him. And he was 14 at the time, and I still have him. He'll be 31 in April.
Wow.
So then it was just kind of a slow build for a while. I got a corn snake, I want to say 4 or 5 years later. Still have him. And then it just kind of, I kind of took a break from reptile world for a bit, got really heavy into bird keeping for a while. I want to say around 2017, 2018, got really heavy back into reptiles with crested gargoyle geckos, and then started getting back into, Asian colubrids, North American colubrids, and then just it exploded from there.
Yeah, nice. So, what have you got in your collection at home at the moment? Obviously, you don't need to go through every single animal, but sort of give us a rough idea.
Primarily, I would say most of my focus is on like Indo-Australian pythons and North American colubrids. So a lot of the kings, the milks, rat snakes. I have most of the North American rat snakes in my collection.
Cool.
I have a lot of old world rats as well. So I have like the bimaculata, the mandarins, bamboo, Chinese king, beauty snakes, and then I have some other things. Rear fangs. I have a few. Geckos, I have a few assorted tortoises, blue-tongued and monkey-tail skinks. I have a savanna monitor, and that's a just a broad way to categorize
Yeah,
everything. I
nice. And
want to say,
some birds in the background as well there.
yeah, sorry about that. That's why
That's
I've
fine, I
got
don't
the
mind.
earbud in.
I don't mind at all. I quite like the sound of the birds in the background.
I was going to say there's actually two doors, and one of which is designed to try and block the sound. But if you've ever had a conure, you know how loud they are, and you can hear them across a city
That's
block.
incredible. So, quite an eclectic mix of animals, a bit of everything at home. I don't want to go into everything that you keep today because we will be here forever. But if anybody does want to go and see a bit more, your Instagram is probably one of my favorite Instagram accounts because every single post is something completely different from the last post. I just love it. But something you've been posting quite a lot recently that I want to touch on today, and it's in the title of the episode as well, is the venomous stuff. So what are you currently keeping in like the hot side of the hobby?
Are we counting rear fanged or just proper venomous?
Let's say proper venomous. You can do rear fangs as well if you want to go through them.
I mean, I only have three rear fangs, so I have a Baron's Racer. The Baron's Racer, I do have about a 6 foot false water cobra. And then I have a red beaked snake,
Okay.
which those are a little bit less common, but still a those in the Baron's Racer and the water cobra are on the more medically significant end of the rear fang
Yeah.
spectrum. And then as far as proper venomous, I only have two. I have a northern copperhead. And then I have the Komodo Island Insularis Viper, which is the blue
Which is just absolutely stunning. I was trying to find a picture to put it on the chat earlier, but my laptop wasn't working. So go and, like I said, go and check out Chris's Instagram because this is just one ridiculously good looking snake. So
She's a favorite, so.
She's absolutely stunning. So speaking to you in the past, and obviously I can see what you're popping on your Instagram story and stuff a lot, you are super passionate about like sharing the correct knowledge and husbandry about all the animals, but like specifically at the moment we're talking the venomous stuff, so your insularis. I like that every time you pop up a post with the venomous stuff, you do put a disclaimer as well about working with venomous animals, how they're not great, like they're not good pets. And a lot of people don't do this, and I think it's something that is really important to share. Now I know that the legalities vary from state to state in America and from country to country as well. But if there was someone listening today and is thinking about venomous, like thinking about adding something venomous, not rear fang, but like proper venomous, so to speak, to their collection, what advice would you give them? And what's your sort of experience in keeping like hots as opposed to a ball python or a rat snake?
So, back in a prior life, I used to work for my local like animal shelter rescue type organization, and the city that we were stationed in, we had a large nature preserve, and we had a lot of urban sprawl kind of backing up to that. So we had Mosaga rattlesnakes in the area, which are not on the scale of venomous, they're less deadly than a copperhead would be. They're fairly small, but I had a lot of experience with relocating those out of the areas surrounding the property and moving them out of when people would get them in their yards or things like that. I had a friend who did some work with Fenimus who, showed me some hook work. And part of my thing is I'm actually allergic to a lot of animals. So I have always been very liberal with hook training most of my animals, and having some of the, like the Maclotz Python, my Baron's Racer, even though she's small, usually when I get her out, I have to hook her because she will charge and try and bite a lot of things in the cage.
Okay.
So I kind of went through this whole thing where I had scrub pythons, I had green trees, I had animals that were a little bit more defensive, and being me and not wanting to get bitten by anything, because, a lot of the venomous keepers that you see on YouTube and TikTok, it's very clickbaity. They're trying to get the animal agitated. And
Yeah.
as far as I'm concerned, if you have a venomous animal, the only time you're interacting with it is if you need to do some kind of servicing the enclosure and you need to fully remove them from the enclosure, in which case I have a locking bucket they go into, screw the top down, clean the enclosure. There's never anything done in the enclosure when they're in there. So
Yeah.
my big thing has always been, dual hooking. I've done it with lots of species. I kind of worked up to that from having, just the field work basis with the rattlesnakes and then kind of growing from there.
Right, okay. Okay, so yeah, and I always think venomous snakes more so than like the venomous lizards, but the snakes especially, because they're so fast, it's almost a bit like playing Russian roulette. Like you have to be so careful, or because all it takes is a split second. So yeah, hook training is obviously something that everyone should be doing that really anyway. Like the less chance of getting bitten by anything is always better.
Yeah, hook training, and then there's honestly so many things that go into it. And coming from I worked heavily for a while with oh, sorry, didn't realize I had a light flicking on behind me. But I worked again heavily with animal rescue, and we would do behavior modification protocols. So to me, having a routine established with those medically significant rear fangs and with the true venomous is very important. And just being aware of things like, for example, my copperhead is in a large Exoterra with a screen roof, but
Yeah.
even though, he's a small snake still, he's only about a foot and a half long. The Exoterra is one of the very tall ones, so there is no way he is physically able to bite through the mesh at the top.
Yeah.
Because that's something people don't realize is they can get you through air holes in the enclosure. They can bite through mesh. So you really have to be careful about that. Whenever you're opening an enclosure, I mounted adhesive little hooks onto the door so I can actually stand back, take hooks, and open the doors of the Exoterra without having to be near it.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where you have to think of every possibility. You have to plan for ways to keep them contained if there were ever an escape. There's a facility down in Florida that does bite protocols, and you can actually contact them, tell them what species you have, and they will print out a bite protocol. So should you ever have a bite, you can actually take that to the emergency room, and it will walk them through medical treatment for that, how to get the antivenin, and then forms like with the Insularis, being that she is not a native species, the antivenin comes from Malaysia. So
Right.
you actually have to have a release form for a non-USDA regulated medication to be administered to you.
Wow. So wow, there's a lot to it then. What? How? What's the temperament like? I don't have any experience with venomous at all. I think I've seen a rattlesnake in a Viv in a shop once, and that was it. So what are they? Are they like? I'm not encouraging people to go and pick one up or anything, but are they as likely to bite as, say, a I don't know, a grumpy corn snake, or are they are they sort of more bitey or less bitey, or is it down to the animal? Or, do you know what I mean?
I would say it's down to the animal,
Yeah.
but then I would say some of it does break down to the species, kind of like with anything. You could get a really nice carpet python, you could get a really bad one.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people will say copperheads are really bad for hook or like riding a hook, and mine has always been very good about hook work. He's only in the 2 years I've kept him, he's only really struck at me once or twice, and it was kind of like a half-hearted, like, I walked into the room, walked past him too fast, and
Yeah.
it was like a knee jerk. But both of mine are captive bred, so they're not usually too defensive. The Insularis, being so young, is she's a little bit more tentative about being on a hook, and she's getting better even over the couple, like the 2 or 3 months I've had her now. I've noticed every time I go in there, she's a little bit better. And so it's the whole kind of like establishing that routine and really not deviating from it is one of the most important things, so they know what's coming next.
I suppose it's quite a difficult thing to sort of for the animals to learn as well, because, like, for example, if you had a monitor and you're trying to get it used to you, you can almost interact with them every single day, like physically interact with them as well, be it feeding them from the tongs or just having your hand in the enclosure. Obviously, you can't do that with a venomous snake, and like you said, you don't want to be disturbing it or moving it unless there's a reason for it, be it feeding, cleaning, topping up waters, whatever the case is. So I imagine it's a much longer, slower process as well.
It is, and the other thing that I think kind of doesn't get talked about is if I need to do something with my venomous, it is something where I make sure it is totally calm around me. There's no distractions because you need to be able to watch everything. And it's one of the things that kind of makes it difficult is if you have a bad day, but you need to do something with the venomous, you need to be able to just shut it down or just say, I can't do it today. I need to come back to this as soon as I am in the right headspace, because it's something where even though neither of the two species I keep are as venomous as, say, like an elapid, if I had an allergic reaction, it would absolutely kill me. And at best case scenario, it's, nerve and tissue damage to the affected area.
But we don't want that. We don't want any bites at all, let
No.
alone anything at all. So yeah, no, that's fair enough. It's definitely something that I'd like to get some experience with, but at the same time, it's not something that I personally would keep at home. Mainly because I've got the dogs and kids, and there's too many external factors that could go pear-shaped. But it's definitely something that I'd like to possibly have a chance at, like interact with a hook or feeding or something like that in the future. I don't know if that's something that could ever happen, but there's just something, there's something about venomous. They're really cool.
They're very different, and especially like the copperhead was. I said early on I was only going to have one. I really like copperheads. A lot of people say they're, because they're not as medically significant, that's the first hot you get. That or like a pygmy rattlesnake, which I didn't want anything massive. I didn't want an elapid. I'm not really into most rattlesnakes. And just being able to set up the enclosure, they're. He's in more of a naturalistic type setup. I'm sure you've seen it on my page. The Insularis, because she's so small, is still in more of a sterile type arboreal setup just to monitor her until she's older. But he's just, it's so fascinating watching him interact and just the way he watches. Like, I've seen very few reptiles other than monitors and my Apodora who are as keyed into every movement, and it's probably, I'm sure it's due to the, the heat pits they have, but just so keyed into every movement.
He's just there watching you all the time. Yeah, no, that's cool. I find even my, like you said, monitors as well. Like my three Gilenite monitors are in my kitchen, like above head height. And every time I walk in there, they can be not there. I'll turn around and they're there. They're all three of them are there watching my every move. I don't know if I get if it would freak me out a little bit knowing there's something. But I know actually. Would I be? No, it's an enclosure. It doesn't matter. I'm rambling. I'm rambling.
No, you're good. I mean, what you were saying though is like at first when I first got the copperhead, I had this whole like, oh my God, there is a venomous reptile in my home. But then when you think about it, tarantulas are venomous, and there are medically significant tarantulas that people keep as pets, and we don't bat an eye at it.
That's true. I used to have quite a few of them, and you are right. I never batted an eyelid. Like even moving them around, like I was like, get a catch cup, poke it with a brush or a straw, not a problem at all. But
Exactly.
would
So
not do that with
obviously
a
it's
copperhead.
no, but like obviously it's different with a snake, and you have to, have your precautions in place. But if you follow and you have that strict set of guidelines of things you do and don't do, it's much I don't want to say it's easier, but it makes it harder to deviate from things, and then it just becomes, this is a snake that I can't touch.
No, that makes perfect sense. I people ask me so my mourning geckos, I know they don't relate at all to venomous, but they're not an animal that gets handled at home at all because they're just fast and they don't like there's no point. And quite often I'm asked, oh, what's the point in having them? And I try and explain it like a fish tank. So if you have tropical fish or marine fish or just goldfish, you don't go and stroke the fish, do you? You sit and you enjoy them, and it's the same thing as that for me.
Yep, that is exactly it. I have like the beaked snake. I have a few pythons that I really don't interact with. I have a Brazilian rainbow boa that I absolutely do not touch unless I have to. So it's easy enough to just have them in a setup that kind of self-maintains to a point and just enjoy observing them. You interact to feed. If you have to, you double hook them out. The interaction is kept very minimal, so it keeps the risk very minimal as well.
And it's not just the risk to you either, it's the risk to the animal as well, because obviously that if there's potential for them to bite you or freak out or whatever, they could get injured as well as necessarily biting you. So it makes perfect sense. Makes absolute perfect sense. So moving away from venomous stuff, because I think we've touched on that a bit. We could sit here and chat about venomous all day, but what I wanted, like, I originally messaged you after seeing a post on your Instagram, because you are very passionate about the reptile hobby. I don't know how to word this, so I'm going to struggle, but I'm hoping you can sort of take the reins a bit.
All right.
So what have I got? So you're not only passionate about reptiles, but also the way that the animals themselves are kept, be it in a room-sized enclosure, in a rack, or something in between. You're not. I've struggled. Oh, hang on. I mean, right. Sort myself out. So yeah, be it in a rack, a room-sized enclosure, or something in between, you're very passionate about not necessarily providing the. I don't know how to word it, but like not. So for example, a leopard gecko. Although they would thrive in a room-sized enclosure, they also will be absolutely fine in a 3 by 1.5 by 1.5 or a 4 by 2 by 2 or whatever. And there seems to be quite a large divide in the hobby as well. They go hand in hand almost. The people that are like, racks are awful, you should never use them, or you should always have UVB, and you. You're much better at putting it into words than I am, and clearly I'm really struggling. So if you could take the reins and try and explain to the listeners what I'm trying to explain very poorly.
So the best way I can put this, and do you mind if I kind of dive into reptile history for a
Go
minute?
for it. You can go dive into reptile history for an hour if you want to.
Okay. So when I was growing up in reptile world in the early mid 2000s, like circa, think like 2007 to 2010 was when I was a young kid. It was the you got a tank, and at the time, a ball python, you kept it in a 40 in a 40 gallon enclosure. If it was a leopard gecko, you kept it in a 10. Bearded dragon was 40, etc., etc. So the standards back then were very different from what they are now. And I would like to preface by saying I will never criticize anyone for giving their animal as big an enclosure as they humanly can, because I think that's awesome. I have multiple 6-foot enclosures throughout my house for various animals. But the thing is, at the time, the hobby has always had the people that kept the leopard gecko in the 10-gallon aquarium on the reptile carpet with a hide at one end and a water dish at the other and a heat lamp up above. And that was it. Which, at any point in the hobby, that was not good or proper. But then you had the people that, back when I was younger, could take that 10-gallon and they would put, a couple inches of substrate in there. They would put multiple hides. I always say you would tier things. So, like, if you've seen my enclosures, you see there's usually a couple hides. There's usually like rocks or branches, and it's stacked, so there's layers. And people learned how to maximize the space within the enclosure, because at the time the appropriate enclosure was a 10 gallon. Of course, people went above that, but it wasn't as common as it is nowadays. Sorry, my cat
That's
tried
fine.
to jump up here. So, as much as I say I like dogs, I have cats. But so nowadays we see such a push for the larger enclosures, which I fully support if you have it. But then you have people that, for example, I think you saw my animals at home interview. I think that was
Yeah,
when we
that was,
started talking.
yeah, definitely.
So, like, I had someone, because I will say I have a rescue bearded dragon who, he lives in a 40 gallon. And the thing was, when I got him, he had never been in a well set up enclosure, is the only way I can word it. And so I did the thing that I did, because at the time I got him, he 40 was still this was before the 4x2x2 minimum came out. So what I did was I took rocks and paving stones and I built a hide in one end that he can go inside of. He's got about 3 to 4 inches of substrate. He's got hides at the other end. He's got branches throughout that I've actually like screwed together, so it's actually like a hardscape inside the enclosure. And then, of course, you know, we learned how to do the lighting and the heating and everything properly for him. But I had someone once tell me, you need to strive for my enclosure. And I brought this up on Animals at Home, and he sent me a picture of a wooden 4x2x2 that had a dollhouse couch at one end, a bin of moist cocoa in the middle, and a singular piece of cork bark in the center. And that was all it had. No substrate, no, not even shelf liner. It was literally an empty wooden box, because the mindset is space is the only important factor, which I agree. Space is a very important factor to take into consideration, but it should not be the only thing we are taking into account when we house our animals. There are modicums of enrichment, taking that animal's individual wants and needs into account, because I mean, I know you don't really keep them as heavily anymore, but you used to keep ball pythons,
Yeah, a
you
lot.
know. And I've seen countless ball pythons, and I work heavily in reptile rescue over here. And we'll see ball pythons that are, they shut down. If you put them in a big enclosure, they won't eat and they get shell shocked by it. You put them in a rack and they eat immediately. So there's one of the big things I've started saying is, as much as I like to align with the advancing herp husbandry part of the hobby, you know, I'm part of that group, I'm part of the reptile lighting group, reptile enrichment and training, I'm in all those groups. But at the same time, if we want, my whole mindset is, if we want to say that reptiles are as intelligent and individual as dogs and cats, which is one side of the argument that's being pushed, we also need to then accept that there will be individual differences between animals. Some animals will not want to use a massive enclosure. I've seen the new minimum for a blue-tongued skink being pushed as 6x3x3 as a bare minimum, which, if you want to provide that, I'm all for it. But my two blue tongues are in 4 foots and they're fine. And I can tell you 90% of the time they are in a burrow and I don't see them. You know, even with basking and UV opportunities and branches and things like that, I still don't see them. I don't see a need for their welfare for them to need that amount of space when they are already not utilizing the space at hand.
No, I
Does
completely
that
agree.
make sense?
Yeah, that does make perfect sense. One of the things on your Animals at Home interview was the Bredel's python you used as a good point, because I've had experience with carpet pythons and Bredel's pythons. I don't keep them now, but I know when I was listening to that, I was listening going, yep, I know exactly what you mean. So the point you made was that it was with a Bredel's python. If you kept carpets or Bredel's, you'll know that when they're an adult, they can have as much room as they want, and 95% of the time they're sat in a ball, either on the floor or on a stick, and they don't move from that at all.
Absolutely. And I think part of that is because the really big care guide website, I don't know how it is in the UK, and I'm not trying to start drama, but over
No.
here, Reptifiles is a really big website. And I think a lot of the care on that website is excellent, but there is a lack of addressing the growth stages for the individual animal. Because I think you and I could both say you and I are at the point in our reptile keeping careers, so to speak, that we could probably take a hatchling carpet python, put it in a 6x3x3 enclosure, and ultimately, if we set it up properly, it will be okay.
Yes.
But if someone has never had a carpet python and they get a 6x3x3, and you know, I'm sure you'll agree with me, there is so much thought and planning that goes into heating a massive enclosure like that.
Yeah.
You know, especially now that we're leaning more away from radiant heat panels and more onto overhead halogens and
Yeah.
deep heat projectors and things like that. There is such a steep learning curve coming into the hobby now compared to the early mid 2000s
Yeah, definitely.
that it's almost, I don't want to say it gatekeeps, but it is bordering on the point where unless you have thousands of dollars and 6 feet by 4 feet of your house to give away. And I think the minimum that Reptifiles says for a Brettles python is 8x4x4. And I
Which
mean,
is massive.
it's absolutely massive. It's larger than what I have my water cobra in. And a water cobra is a far more active snake than a Brettles. And
Yeah.
my water cobra is in a 6x3. And he's totally fine. He still has ample room to move around. He's got adequate enrichment. And that's the thing is I strongly believe there are certain factors with each species that you cannot overlook. Like if
Yeah.
you have a carpet or a boa, you have to be able to give them some opportunity to perch and to elevate because they have muscles that will atrophy if you don't.
Yeah.
However, does that need to be an 8 foot? No. I mean, I think for years the minimum was length plus width of the enclosure should equal or exceed the length of the snake inside. And I
Yeah.
like to say 1.5 times the snake's length in total should be length plus width of the enclosure, minimum.
Yeah. So if you've got a 10-foot snake, you want 15-foot being the back and the side together.
Exactly, because you
Yeah.
need to be able to give them that. You really need to see that or give them that ability to let that lung stretch out for the majority of their body because we see it in the big snake community, the retics, the berms, that when they're not able to uncoil because they're kept in such a small enclosure, they're much more susceptible to upper respiratory, pneumonia, lung damage as a result.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And the gatekeeping bit as well. So I don't know what I think. Beardies, are they pushing 4x3x3s now? Either way,
6x3x3
yeah,
is what they're
six
pushing
by three
now.
by three for beardies. So if you're a child or a young teen, and let's face it, beardies are like the gateway drug to reptile keeping. But if you so if they're pushing an enclosure that size, and then you need overhead heat, thermostat, UVB, LED lighting, everything else. You're like you say, you're looking at thousands of pounds to get into the hobby. And whilst I'm if you can afford it, obviously go and do it. I'm not saying don't. But at the same time, if a child is, or whoever's getting into the hobby is buying a bearded dragon for 50 quid or up thereabouts, they're not very expensive, and it's a hatchling, so it's what, 5 inches long, tip to tail, if that. They don't need that size enclosure. They can have a 3 foot or a 4 foot that has some height, some heat. I always push UVB as well. But you can start basic and then learn and improve as you go. And I think that's more of a way to do it. Like you say, otherwise you are gatekeeping and people are going, oh, well, I'd like that, but I can't do it. It's like marine fish tanks, for example. Like, I would love a marine fish tank, but I know there's so much money involved in starting one because you can't start really cheap. There's no way of doing it. But with reptiles, you can. And I think that's one of the beautiful things of reptiles as well.
See, and that's something that I'm starting to see increasingly more online is there's a huge push that if you can't afford that final adult setup with all the bells and whistles in one fell swoop right off of step one, you shouldn't get the animal.
Yeah.
And the thing that I see people pushing all the time, and especially from the more advanced side of the hobby, is we need, you know, these are wild animals. We need to give them every opportunity they would have in the wild. We need to mimic that life. And I mean, I think you could probably agree with me if we got a farm bred baby ball python imported from Ghana and put it next to any of the four gene morph ball pythons out there. They're not the same animal
No, I
anymore.
completely agree.
And that, and something this will probably be my most controversial hot take. The hobby likes to pick and choose what is considered ethical and what is considered unethical, because when people say, I want my animal to experience, or I want my boa to be kept as close to a wild boa as possible. If you are feeding that animal on a schedule, that is artificial. I mean, by nature, captivity is an artificial environment. That animal is confined, no matter how big the enclosure is, it is still a snake in a box. And the thing is, when you are having a captive animal, you are denying them the ability to thermoregulate in a much broader area. They are not being exposed to elements. They are not being exposed to parasites. They are not being exposed to famine. They are not fighting for territory. They are not being bred by a passing male. There are things that, if you did to your pet animal, what happens to them in the wild, someone would say it's unethical. And so we like to pick and choose what fits the ethos of the argument at hand.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Something you said on the Animals at Home podcast, and I haven't written it down. I should have done because I went, oh, that is really good. I can't remember it word for word, but you said something along the lines of where, at what point do we say that is the minimum and that is enough, or something along those lines.
Yes, because there's one of the things, and I've seen it, and this is not an attack, but I've seen, because I follow a lot of people over in Germany, Switzerland, the UK on Instagram, I see a lot of accounts saying that we always need to exceed the minimum. But when the minimum is being increased to a point where the minimum for a Brettles python is 8 by 4 by 4, at what point do I now have to give one python an entire bedroom because it's exceeding the minimum? But my question is, what is the true minimum? Because what a lot of people don't understand is when you go and you find these husbandry websites, like again, Reptifiles, she does a lot of really in-depth, good peer-reviewed research into her stuff. Like she cites everything, and I will give her huge credit for that. And this is a where I bring my personal life into it. I work in kind of an animal welfare type job now, where we actually have a book of standards for what is considered adequate and humane for dozens of different species. And I think people would be floored to realize, number one, a lot of the people writing these care guides are writing it purely based on their personal views and what they have read and compiled, which is fine. But if you look at like governing agencies, like for example, welfare for leopard geckos at one of the facilities I work at is they are kept in an enclosure, a single leopard gecko, I would say roughly the size of a 10-gallon aquarium, with a heat source on one end, a hide, a humid hide, and a water dish and a food dish. That is considered minimal welfare. And should we accept that as the minimum for a pet? Absolutely not. We should always exceed that. But there is the minimum, or minimum has been turned into such a negative term. And the phrase, surviving is not thriving, which I agree. But also, if you've ever gone field herping, when you find a wild rat snake over here, it's not this super fit animal. A lot of the times it's scarred, it's missing an eye, it's beat up, it's skinny. Wild reptiles are not this epitome of health like we think. They do often just survive in their native habitat as well. So do we need to do better than that? Absolutely. Do we need to exceed a minimum of some sort? Yes. But is the bar for minimum being set too high? Is where I am starting to lean towards yes.
Yeah, no,
But
I completely, I get exactly what you're saying. I do agree with you, to an extent. Obviously, there's some things that everybody will, they have their own opinion, and everyone's entitled to their own opinion. But things like, it's difficult. Like, so I've been keeping royals since I was 13, so 12 years, if my math is
Okay.
correct. A long time, anyway. So I'm 31 now. However long that is, and they've always been kept in racks. And it wasn't up until recently, like mid last year, that I actually decided, you know what, I've had enough of racks. They're gone. Don't like them anymore. Mm-hmm. That's my own personal opinion. I don't have anything against anybody keeping in racks. The racks have a place. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the size of a footprint of a rack compared to the size footprint of what is the minimum recommended size for a Royal Python now, in the UK, we've got new guidelines that come out. I think it's a 4x2x2, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you look at the rack. And so there's industrial racks that are being sold, like Freedom Breeder or mm-hmm. whoever else is selling them. And the footprint of one of those is not even 3 foot by a foot and a half. But we know they do fine in them. And I'm not saying don't give them more space and don't give them overhead heating and UVB, and I'm sure they can benefit from all that. But like, I completely agree with you. Where do you draw the line? Like, and that is it's a wavy line. It's not a straight dead set line. And I think, especially for new keepers that don't have enough knowledge to be able to make their own decisions, there needs to be almost like a Reptiles for Dummies guide, that this is like, there needs to be more levels. So it needs to be like, this is the bare minimum, but they'll be all right. This is like a 3-star or a 4-star or a 5-star, but all of them are suitable, if you know what I mean. I try to put into word what I'm saying.
No, I absolutely understand what you're saying, and I agree with you. There is a level of minimum that is like, yes, if I go to someone's house and they show me their ball python and it's on, you know, granted, I don't like reptile carpet, okay?
Yeah.
Let me put that out there. But if I see a ball python...
Nobody should like reptile carpet. It's awful stuff.
Yeah, it's terrible. But if I go to someone's house and I see their 15-year-old ball python in a 40-gallon tank, they spray the tank down, it's on reptile carpet, there's a hide at each end, one's warm, one's cool, and there's a branch for it to hide on, I'm not going to ream them for it. I'm not going to, you know, fight them over it, because at the end of the day, are you familiar with the 5 freedoms of animal welfare?
No, not at all, mad.
It's like freedom from pain, freedom from fear and stress, freedom to exhibit natural behavior, freedom from hunger, freedom from thirst, things like that. Right. And it's a really big thing in the animal welfare field. But even if you look at some of these more minimal enclosures, a lot of them do still cover the 5 basic tenets of animal welfare. Even though now I know there's a push that UV should be provided for every single reptile ever, which I offer UV to most of my legged reptiles, all my tortoises, skinks, all that. I am pro UVB. I've rotated UVB through my snakes and I saw no benefit. And frankly, the whole every reptile ever needs UV argument, for a lot of the more like diurnal active species, or, you know, I've seen some stuff like coach whips are very diurnal active daytime species. So there's some talk that they might need more UVB than other species.
Yeah.
But until we pull blood chemistry from every species out there on and off UVB, can we really say that every reptile needs UVB?
Yeah. No, it does make perfect sense. I'm not educated enough to make any statements really. So my Royals never had UVB, and like I said, I never noted. I didn't notice any detrimental effects. Whereas I know, like, I've got a Yemen chameleon, veiled chameleon. I know if that thing hasn't got UVB for a month, it'll end up with metabolic bone disease and probably just keel over and die. And obviously, if you're looking at the care sheets, that's something that is there straight away. Make sure they've got UVB. It's really important. Make sure you are supplementing them. It's really, really important. Whereas some other species, ball pythons, for example, pop in a rack, feed them, they'll be fine. So it's difficult. Just going back to the minimums quickly, a comment is there from Serenity Dragon saying, the minimum enclosure is a necessary metric, but it's also a trap. People hear minimum enclosure size and they think, oh, okay, all I need is a 4x2x2. But what it really means, the second comment, is start here and give it more if you can. So the minimum isn't the stopping point, but a lot of people interpret it that way.
Mm-hmm. And I can agree with that. I mean, I think what people need to understand, though, is that, like, you and I, and I'm sure everyone in the chat right now, we are all very deeply invested into the hobby. We are reptile people. That is why you have this podcast. That is why I am here. The majority of people that keep reptiles are not us.
Yeah, no, I completely
And
agree.
that's something we see so much around here. Like, I just, to put things into perspective, if you look on Morph Market, right, there are 43, 44,000 ball pythons on Morph Market alone. That's not counting Craigslist, Kijiji, any of those other,
Yeah.
classified sites. The question I always put out there is there a home willing to provide minimum 4x2x2 for every single ball python? And the push for every animal has to be on bioactive. Every ball python needs UVB and rotating the prey between mice and rats and soft fur and quail and all the stuff that is incredibly beneficial. But to the average person who wants to buy a leopard gecko at PetSmart, and they're 16 and they want their first reptile. Are we going to start policing and saying, no, you can't have this animal unless you have X? And then, as to build off of that, how many people are we going to then prevent from entering the hobby because we are setting the standard too high?
Yeah.
But also, how many animals now can we not find any form of placement for because the minimum for ethical and humane, air quotes, has been pushed to such a level that we can't even rehome them because the rescue I work with right now, and I volunteer with heavily, we have like 47 adult ball pythons in rescue right now. We have 6 redfoot tortoises, and we are the only rescue in our state. We can't even take bearded dragons. We had yesterday alone, we had someone ask to surrender their entire breeding project of crested geckos, a blue-tongued skink, and 2 bearded dragons.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, the COVID is over. A lot of people got into the hobby that were not in the hobby. They wanted to breed. They are realizing the time and the expense it takes, and they want out. But now we have more reptiles needing homes than ever before. So at what point do we need to understand that, yes, 4x2x2 is an ideal minimum,
Yeah.
but is there a humane option that can provide them with all their needs that is smaller?
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I think it'd be much better. Let's use ball pythons as an example. It'd be much better for, say, them to be surrendered into what would be going into a rack system where they're going to get fed, they're going to get clean, they're going to get clean water. Whereas the other option is they stay where they are currently, but the person's lost interest, they get neglected, and eventually they end up sick and die. So I think they'd be better off in a smaller enclosure, not necessarily getting overhead lighting, but they're getting a basking spot that's the right temperature. They're getting fed, they're being cleaned, they're being provided fresh water, which is enough. And like that is a point, I suppose, where it's sort of surviving and not thriving, but they're also that has to be there at some point, because otherwise they're all going to get neglected and they're going to get dumped, they're going to get released into the wild, or a lot of them will end up in people's freezers, which is another horrible thing.
I was going to say that's the next bit is, do we reach a point where we've set the minimum so high that the only option is to put them down because there isn't the home available, which I'm sure none of us want to see that point happen, but I'm in ball python groups and there have been talks a lot lately that people are starting to do that with the low end animals.
Yeah, I've seen the same sort of chat, which is it's horrible. That's one of the reasons that I decided that was it. I'd had enough, and the ball pythons are going. Despite having them for however many years I've had them for, looking at them in the racks, I wanted to be able to provide them with more space, and I couldn't provide every single one with more space, and I didn't want to have to pick and choose. So I made the decision: they're all going. I'll start again. And they've gone to different homes. Some of them will stay in racks, some of them will go into bigger vivs, but I know that they're all going to be cared for, and I'm happy with that. And I'm really happy now with where I'm at with what's at home. But I lost my train of thought completely. I don't know where I was going with that. I'm really sorry.
No, you're good.
Yeah. So, yeah, no. But, yeah, like you say, there's a lot of chat. Well, there's not a lot, but I'm seeing it in some of the reptile groups. There's a bit more quiet here, but people don't tend to talk about it as much in the UK. But there are people that are euthanizing their, like, the normals or their single gene animals, mm-hmm. or even like the 2-3 gene animals that they just can't mm-hmm. sell. It's absolutely yeah. mad.
I was going to say, there was someone actually fairly local to me who is a boa breeder, and he basically got excommunicated from the reptile community around here because yeah. he admitted that if he had an animal that he couldn't sell quick enough or it was a low-end animal, regardless of how long he had had it, he would just, and he admitted to just freezing them to death.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think that's a point we want to get to. No. I mean, none of us want to get there, but at the same time, if we keep pushing these, you know, for a common boa, you need a 7x4x4 with UV and heating. And when you go to some of these care guide sites and they tell you, oh, here's the cost investment. I saw that for, you know, going to monitors, they were talking about ACCIs and the minimum yeah. setup. And it actually says in the care guide, there is not a humane enclosure that you can buy for any point in an ACCI's life that is not custom built.
Yeah, right, okay.
Which, and it said, like, the minimum investment to buy an ACCI or to set up the enclosure for the ACCI before you actually bought the ACCI was somewhere between $1,500 and $1,800. Just for the... It's absolutely insane. I mean, and, you know, I've heard some people saying the whole... Well, when you buy an animal, you expect to have cost associated with it, which I don't think there's a person who really doesn't.
Yeah.
But, I mean, do you have a dog?
I have three.
Okay. So, I was going to say, I thought you had a few, but... Yeah. So, like, when you got your dogs, did you have money set aside for every single thing that dog would need?
Nope.
Right off the bat?
No, I had a dog, and I went... Right, this is how much the dog is, that's how much my insurance is, we'll work everything else out.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and there's this whole push with reptiles that you need to have everything the most expensive right off the bat, and it's becoming a huge divide in the hobby because you get the people who have been around, kind of like you and I have, we know that there is a minimum you need to meet,
yeah,
but it may not be as extreme as some sides are pushing. But it's better than a rack with paper towel and a hide and a water dish and nothing else.
Yeah, I completely agree. So that's a good example. Like, so I've recently upgraded all my leopard geckos to have LED lighting, whereas before they just had a basking bulb and a UVB. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to put LEDs with everything because not only does it mm-hmm. make the enclosure look better, they benefit from it, apparently. Yep. I've been told and I've read. And if you go on to... like Google and you search reptile, the first things that come up are Arcadia and the new Luminize stuff. Which, don't get me wrong, it's incredible, but an LED, a Luminize LED is like £100.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And don't get me wrong, they're really good. They simulate the sunlight and the dawn and the dusk, and it's really, really cool. And I've got them in some of my monitors enclosures. In the leopard gecko's enclosures, I have got 6,500 Kelvin. I don't know what length they are, but they're under-counter LED lights that you would use in your kitchen. Mm-hmm. And I got them on eBay for $8.99. And they work. They don't do the dimming up and the dimming down, but they come on and they're bright and they work. They're perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't know that or you haven't got the experience, you go on Google, like I said, and you Google LED lighting, you're instantly there, like £100 here, £100 there. And it just becomes very unaffordable very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's another thing is even over, I know over in the UK, it's a lot easier for you guys to get Arcadia. Like, it's pretty difficult to get Arcadia over here. You basically have to order it from a specialty place online, and there's only a few places that really have it. Yeah. We have a few shops that have started, you know, carrying it, and they rebrand it as a different thing, but when you pull it out, it's Arcadia. But there's even a push for... Even if you're offering UVB, you shouldn't offer anything other than Arcadia because all other UVBs are not correct. But we've
I've
had
heard of them.
Zilla and Zoomed around for 15, 20, 30 years, and they've been fine the entire time.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Like, I've always used Arcadia because I've always been told to use Arcadia, but like the I think it's because of the percentages as well. So like if you look at most care guides, they're always recommending like the 12% Arcadias, for example. And then you look at I think it's Zoomed, I might be wrong, but they don't offer a 12%. Theirs is the Reptisun 10%, or it's called the Reptisun 10.0. So you automatically go, that's not quite what I've been told to get. And if you don't have the knowledge, then you just automatically buy the more expensive Arcadia one. I just want to bring up a comment from Paul that says, Leopard geckos will benefit more from the Luminizer than the monitors. I know that, Paul. The whole conversation we're having here is that I can't afford to buy stuff straight away. So using the LEDs that are cheaper on eBay is better than having nothing at all. And at some point, they will be getting Luminize. Unless you want to pay for them now, mate. There's four Vivs to do, please.
See, I think the biggest thing is like when the Luminize came out, which let me just say, I think the whole like the dimming up and like the ramping up and the ramping down is a great thing. But I heard a lot of the initial like people that were talking about being like, oh, lights just flicking on and off is incredibly stressful to an animal. When the lights come on in my Savannah monitor's enclosure, he doesn't open his eyes.
No,
mean,
again, my leopard geckos, they're not sleeping out in the open. They like, don't get me wrong, they probably would come out like when it's ramping up slowly, and they probably do more, is it crepuscular basking? I know the word, I don't know the word I
The
mean, but
cryptic.
yeah, so they're sort of like half in, half out, like, and I probably see them doing that more, but they are still doing it. And I've noticed now, because I've got like the halogens on without anything else on, I'm seeing them around a bit more as well. So it might happen at some point. But the Luminizer is really cool. Right, we have been going for pretty much an hour, and I'd like to keep it about an hour because that's where we tend to be. I'm sure we could go on for hours, but we will call it there for now, and we can always do a part two. So it's time for me to wrap up. So, Chris, thank you very much for coming on. There is
Yeah,
one
thank you
more
for having me.
question that I would like to ask you before we finish up for the day, and that is the final wrap-up question of the podcast. And that is, if you could give your 10-year-old self a piece of advice, what would that advice be?
The advice legitimately would be happiest with what you have and be more picky about what you keep.
No,
That's my
that's
biggest
really
thing.
good. Yeah, I like that. That's really good. I think when I was sort of younger, even when I wasn't younger, to be fair, it's very easy to accumulate a lot of stuff. And now I've got rid of everything and I'm sort of starting from scratch again. And I've told myself, this is the enclosures, that's it. I'm being really picky and I'm really, really enjoying it. So yeah, fantastic advice. Right, and last but not least, if people want to find you, where can they find you?
If anyone wants to find me, they can find me. I do have a Facebook page that has very little on it. It's Copperhead Reptilia, but then if you do want to find me on Instagram, copperhead.reptilia, always feel free to follow, shoot a message if you want to talk reptile stuff. I am always happy to talk with anyone.
Awesome. I will pop the Chris's link to his Instagram in the show notes below as well. So it'll be super easy for you guys to find. Right, Chris, I'm going to kick you out. Don't go anywhere because we'll have a little catch up before we go completely. But thank you very much for coming on. It was lovely to speak with you.
Yep, thank you for having me. I
No
appreciate it.
worries. Right, there we go. What an episode. Hopefully you guys learned a lot. There's a lot of food for thought there. And yeah, if you want to go and see anything that Chris is chatting about, go and see his cool pictures of his Insularis and all the other stuff. And go and if you just want to chat reptiles, I'm sure he's open for a message. So the link is in the description below. If you want to keep up to date with what's going on with me or the podcast, go on Facebook or Instagram and just search RepTiChat, and I'm sure we will pop up, hopefully. As I mentioned at the top of the show, there is a Patreon available. It opens you up to a private Discord where you get early access to extra content, pre-recorded episodes, some merch, and all some other bits and bobs as well. The link for that is in the show notes below as well. So that's that. I've been your host, Ben McIntyre, and this has been the RepTiChat podcast. I will see you in a fortnight. Bye-bye.